Good morning, everybody. I might wave individually to each of you, and that would be fun. All right. Turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 24. That was good connection, guys. Really fun. Very personable. I'm going to just jump right into it. 1 Samuel chapter 24, we're 3 weeks into a series on the life of King David, which will last 6 weeks, and I'm calling this series Faithfulness Through Adversity. And you look at David's life, you see a lot of adversity, but you also see a lot of faithfulness, definitely not perfection, but a guy who was committed to his God, who trusted in God, and was faithful through thick and thin, even faithful through his own sinful behavior. And so we're looking at what does it look like for us to be faithful in the midst of the challenges that God puts in our life. Last week we looked at the ultimate adversity, this 9-foot giant who threatened to kill the Israelites, Goliath. And we saw this ultimate faithfulness of King David, and he had this perspective, which was, you know what, the battle is the Lord's. This is not my battle, it's the Lord's battle. And that perspective enabled him to move into this very courageous action and do this unbelievably courageous thing and defeat the great giant. So today we're going to look at more adversity and more faithfulness. And I'm skipping about 7 chapters from ahead of where we were last time, so I want to just give you a 30-second kind of catch you up on what's going on. Chapter 17, David defeats Goliath, and then chapter 18, you get these two responses to David. On the one hand, so many people, 3 times it says that people love David. People's hearts just go out to this young shepherd boy who will be king, and they love him. It says that Jonathan, Saul's own son, loves him. Michael, Saul's own daughter, falls in love with him. It says all Israel, all Judah loves David. So you got this one response of just love and admiration, and then you got one guy who has a different response, and that's, of course, King Saul. And 3 times in chapter 18, it says Saul feared David. 3 times. He is threatened by David, of course, by David's popularity, and it says that he is jealous and angry of David, and he's threatened by him. So he tries various strategies with David to deal with his fear. The first one is he keeps a real close watch on David, keeps David close in his company. And when he doesn't like that, he tries a different strategy, which is I'm going to send him out into the front lines and send him out on these really daring military missions. And God is with David, and he survives all these battles. And so then Saul finally resorts to outright just trying to murder David. And 3 times he throws his own spear at David. David eludes that. And we're in a situation now where David has fled, and Saul has taken his armies. He's taken like 3,000 guys, and he is just pursuing David around the country. So we find ourselves really for the rest of 1 Samuel where David is on the run from Saul. The future king is on the run from the current king. And I wanted to just give you a little picture of this. And I know you won't be able to see this very well. It doesn't matter too much. This represents the territory of Israel. And then this is enemy territory out here. So David was in Gibeah. He flees to Ramah. Then he flees to Nob, and Saul's pursuing him. He flees out. He has to go actually out into Philistine country. He goes into this dangerous situation in Gath where he has to pretend like he's crazy because they recognize him and they're going to kill him. So he goes into the area of his enemies. He flees down into wilderness. He takes his family into Moab, into another foreign place, drops them off there, and he's wandering all over the place for about 15 chapters on the run from Saul. You've got David, he's been faithful to God, and now he's basically living as a fugitive. And it's just really exhausting to think about. He's constantly in danger, almost caught, running, fleeing, going all over the country. And the point I want to make this morning before we get into the passage is David is experiencing injustice. He is experiencing injustice from Saul. He has been nothing but faithful to Saul. He's been faithful to Israel. He's been a humble, loyal soldier and subject of Saul, and yet Saul is bent on destroying him. And so David is experiencing this great injustice. And we're going to see some scenes here where he has these unique opportunities to take revenge on Saul and to enact justice for himself, and we'll see what he does. But before we get to it, I want to just have you think about your own lives, and it won't be as dramatic as David's, of course, but I want you to consider maybe somewhere in your life right now or sometime in the past where you experienced injustice, where you really realized, man, I've been mistreated here. What's going on here has not been fair. And think of a situation or maybe even a relationship where you've experienced that kind of, you haven't done anything wrong and yet you're really being mistreated by this person. Okay, for many of you, it might be a work situation. You know, you've got a boss or a coworker where you just really feel like this has not been fair. Maybe it's with someone you don't even know. You know, maybe it's the government. Maybe it's the way the government runs. You go, there's no justice here. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's an old friend that has done something. Maybe it's a past relationship. Maybe it's even a spouse where you go, man, this my fairness meter right now is going off the charts. I want you to think of where you've experienced that. And our theme this morning is going to be words that we're going to hear from David in the final scene, which is this. And this is the title of my sermon. The Lord rewards righteousness and faithfulness. I should probably memorize that one. The Lord rewards righteousness and faithfulness, which I'm going to define basically as trusting in God and doing what's right, even when it's hard. The Lord rewards righteousness and faithfulness, those who trust God and do what's right, even in the midst of injustice. And so last week, we really were dealing with the emotion of fear. When there's things that threaten us and we feel fear, there's a courage that can come from knowing that the battle belongs to the Lord. And this morning, the primary emotion really is anger. You know, the anger we feel when things aren't fair, when there's injustice. And yet there's a righteousness and a faithfulness that can come from knowing that vengeance belongs to the Lord, that God is the God of justice, and revenge belongs to him alone. All right, so let's get into this. We have three chapters, these three scenes today that I really don't think you can read them in isolation from each other. They're so connected. So I want to read them all, or parts of each one of them. That means we have a lot of reading today, which is going to be the case throughout this whole series when you're trying to cover, you know, like 50 chapters in 6 weeks. You have to cover a lot of chapters. So scene one. David is on the run, and he has this unique opportunity to seek revenge on Saul, and we'll see what he does. So Saul's been pursuing him. He's out in the wilderness, and verse 1 tells us this. It's chapter 24, 1 Samuel. After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. All right, so they're down in En-Gedi. How many of you have been to En-Gedi? Anybody? Okay, En-Gedi is this kind of isolated, rocky, desert place. It's near the Dead Sea. There's a lot of caves there. And Saul's pursuing David, and David is totally outnumbered. Saul has 3,000 of the best men in Israel. David's grouped together like maybe 500 guys, this kind of ragtag group of outcasts that have come along him. But he's totally outnumbered. He's being pursued, and we're wondering what's going to happen. And then in verse 3, there's a real change of fate for David and Saul, or potentially. Listen to this. He came to the sheep pens along the way. Sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the cave. So you got David, he's totally outnumbered. He's threatened, his life is threatened. And then there's this really lucky circumstance where Saul goes to relieve himself by himself, and he just happens to pick the cave that David and all his guys are hiding in. And so it just in a single moment, the power dynamic is totally shifted, and now Saul is alone, he's vulnerable, you know, literally caught with his pants down, right? And David and all his men are out there, and there's this opportunity. And he's been on the run, chased all over the country. And the men see this unique opportunity for what it is, and they say in verse 4, the men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands, for then you for you to deal with as you wish.'" Now, God never actually said that, quite that. He said, in chapter 23, he said, "I'll give the Philistines into your hands, David." But the Philistines are God's enemy. Saul is God's enemy. I mean, it's close enough, right, David? God has clearly set this up for you to take revenge, to take matters into your own hands. So what do you do if you're David? You've got this unique opportunity. You've been chased all over the place, and you have an opportunity to solve your problem in a moment. Well, David does something very interesting. Second half of verse 4. Then David, I would love to have actually seen this, how this went. But then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Verse 5. Afterward, David was conscience stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. Okay, something strange is going on that I think, you know, culturally hard for us to understand. But David goes up and, you know, he's got a sharp knife or something. And he's got to be really quiet. And he cuts off a little corner of Saul's robe. And then afterwards, it literally says his heart struck him for the action. And it seems strange to us. Why is he so, you know, why is that so hard for him? But I think either what he's done is something that culturally would have been very humiliating. Or more likely, David realizes the symbolic nature of what he's done. Saul's robe represents his royal authority that he has as king. And so David cutting it off is kind of this symbolism of cutting Saul's authority and claiming it for himself. And you may remember 2 weeks ago, when we talked about Saul, there was this time where he disobeyed God, and Samuel was said, God is through with you, and he started walking away. And you remember Saul grabbed the hem of Samuel's garment, and it ripped. And Samuel said, you know what? That's a great picture of what's going to happen. Your kingdom is going to be ripped from you and given to another man who's better than you. And so I think David's action is, it's hard to know what he was thinking when he did it, but it is this symbolic kind of laying claim to the throne, taking that for himself, and he's conscious stricken when he does it, and he realizes that's not my place to do that. And so he responds in verse 6 to the men. He comes back and he says to them, the Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, referring to Saul, or lift my hand against him, for he is the anointed of the Lord. With these words, David rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. David realizes, you know, God has anointed me, but Saul was also God's anointed, and God chose him. And now God has chosen me, but he's going to give me the kingdom as a gift. It's not something that I have to take for myself. This is God's doing all the way. So I'm not going to take this for myself. This is going to be God's deal that he's going to do in his own time. And I think he's right in having that perspective. So this incredible restraint, I mean, incredible restraint on the part of David. And so he lets this guy go that has been mistreating him, you know, for maybe years. So Saul leaves the cave. So what do you do if you're David now? Saul's gone. He doesn't know anything happened. I would probably just stay hidden in the cave and wait for the army to pass by. But David does something very gutsy, very risky. Verse 8, then David went out of the cave and called out to Saul, my lord, the king. I figure he's got about 30 seconds to say something really compelling, or Saul's going to come and kill him right then and there. Let's see what he does. When Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. Good start. He said to Saul, why do you listen when men say David has been on harming you? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not lift my hand against my master, because he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. Now understand and recognize that I am not guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. What an amazing picture. David's standing there with the symbol of Saul's kingship, and yet also the symbol of his restraint, and saying, hey, I'm not going to take this from you. Even though you have done harm to me, I am not going to do that same harm to you. That's the Lord's role to do that. And I think this key verse in verse 12, here it is. May the Lord judge between you and me, Saul, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. It's God's role to be judge between us, and he will decide, but I'm not going to play that role with you. Well, what is Saul's response? Many of you know the story. David's words really hit their mark in Saul's heart. Look at verse 16. When David finished saying this, Saul asked, it's like he's waking up from a dream. Is that your voice, David, my son? And he wept aloud. The king in front of his army sees this courageous man risking his life who has spared him, and he just breaks down and he weeps. He says, verse 17, you're more righteous than I. You have treated me well, but I have treated you badly. You have just now told me of the good you did to me. The Lord delivered me into your hands, but you did not kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today. And then this amazing confession of Saul. For the first time, Saul actually publicly confesses that David will one day be king. Verse 20. I know that you will surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. Now swear to me, it's basically saying, when you become king, don't you know, seek vengeance on my kids. Swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family. So David gave his oath to Saul. Then Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. So this amazing encounter, this amazing restraint on David's part, and really this amazing reconciliation in the moment. And you'd think, all right, their problems are over, right? And we'll find out that they're not. All right, so that's scene one. Scene two, chapter 25. So we got two more scenes, and we're going to see these are really connected to each other. Now, this scene has nothing to do with Saul, but it has everything to do with the topic at hand. So, second half of verse 1, chapter 25, David moves down to the desert of Maon, and we're introduced to a couple, a guy and his wife. Verse 2, a certain man in Maon, we'll go with Maon for the day, who had property there at Carmel, was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband, a Calebite, was surly and mean in his dealings. Okay, so we're introduced to this guy, and we learn three things about this guy. First, he's really rich. Second, he's a fool. We'll find out later, Nabal, his name actually means fool, and this guy's an idiot, if I can say it. And we find out that he's mean and surly in his dealings. This is not a good guy. And we learn something about his wife, and she's basically the opposite of that. Her name's Abigail. She's discerning. She's intelligent. She's beautiful. Okay? So we're introduced to them. And we get this request in verse 4. David has a request for this man, this wealthy man. Verse 4. While David was in the desert, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. It's the sheep shearing time. It's a time of festivities, time of a lot of meals and stuff like that. Verse 5, so he sent 10 young men and said to them, go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours. Now I hear that it is the sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, he's saying we've been with your shepherds, we didn't mistreat them. And the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favorable toward my young men, since we come at a festival time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them. So he's saying, hey, we've been good to you. Now, we need some food and stuff like that. We're on the run. Be generous with us. And we know that he's telling the truth. If you look at verse 15, go on. This is one of Nabal's servants, one of their shepherds speaking. And this is what he says about David and his men. Yet these men were very good to us. They didn't mistreat us. And the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. Night and day, they were a wall around us of protection. All the time, we were herding our sheep near them. So David and his men, they've been really gracious, and they protected Nabal and his sheep and his shepherds. And they're saying, hey, can we have some generosity? We're in need. Will you help us? So the men, you know, go report this. And let's look at Nabal, the fool's response. Verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants, who is this David? He knows who David is, but he's saying, who is this guy to me, basically? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shears and give it to men coming from who knows where? I don't know anything to this guy. Why should I be generous with him? So this act of injustice. He's been treated well, and he's going to respond by treating David poorly. So what's David's response to this, the David who showed great restraint in chapter 24? Let's see. Verse 12, David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word, and David said to his men, put on your swords. So they put on their swords, and David put on his. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. So David is like, how dare this guy treat me like this? All right, guys, let's go. We're going to take this guy down. Look at verse 21. This is what David's saying to himself when he's on his way to Nabal. David had just said, it's been useless. All my watching over this fellow's property in the desert so that nothing of his was missing, he has paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David, with me, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him. Okay, and the English doesn't bring out the crudeness, the crassness, the even kind of slightly vulgar of David's language. So you get a very different David in chapter 25. You've got this David who's just shown this great restraint to the king, and now he's been treated unjustly, and he's like, dude, this guy's going down. What does this guy think? This guy's a fool. This guy's saying, I repaid him. I was good to him, and now he's been evil. This is how he treats me? And he says, forbid it. Lord, forbid it if I don't take this matter into my own hands and do something about this. This guy's going to get justice, and he's going to get it quick. Very different, darker side of David in scene two. Well, one of Nabal's servants tells Abigail, this beautiful and intelligent woman, and she ends up being God's gift to David in the midst of his desire for vengeance. So what she does is she makes 200 loaves of bread and 200 skins of wine and figs and cakes and all this stuff, and she sends it out ahead of her to meet David and his men, this generous gift. And then she comes behind that, and she intercepts David on his way to kill Nabal and all the men. So verse 23, when Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey. And I figure, just as with David and Saul, she's got about a minute to say something really convincing that's going to keep David from wrath. So she gets off her donkey, and she bows down before David with her face to the ground. Sound familiar? Sound like the last scene? She fell at his feet and said, "My lord, let the blame be on me alone. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. May my lord pay no attention," she kind of throws her husband on the bus here, "to that wicked man Nabal. He's just like his name. His name is Fool, and folly goes with him," which is totally true. "But as for me, your servant, I did not see the men my master sent." So then she just says these great things. Listen to this, verse 26. Now, she assumes that David's not going to do it. I love, this is great, kind of convincing here. Now, and when she says, "my master," she's referring to David in the scene. "Now, since the Lord has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands," she's assuming he's not going to do this, "as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, may your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal." See, David, you're not going to go do this, I'm hoping. "And since you do this, may God show justice. And let this gift which your servant has brought to my master be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's offense, for the Lord will certainly make a lasting dynasty for you because you fight the Lord's battles. Let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. When the Lord has done for my master every good thing he promised concerning him as appointed him leader over Israel, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. And when the Lord has brought my master success, remember your servant." So, I think the key is verse 26. The Lord is keeping you from bloodshed, David, and from avenging yourself. And then she ends it by saying, when you become king, the great thing is you're not going to have this conscience that just goes against you because of what you could have done today. And God is sparing you from that. Well, her words hit the mark with David, just as David's words hit the mark with Saul. Look at David's response, verse 32. David said to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming it, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak." Then David accepted from her hand what she had brought him and said, "Go home in peace. I have heard your words and granted your request." And so he doesn't go and avenge himself. And then verse 36 tells us what becomes of the fool, Nabal. Verse 36, "When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and very drunk, so she told him nothing until daybreak. Then in the morning when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him, and he became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died." So you have this woman who is so discerning and spares David from avenging himself. And then 10 days later, God basically does this act of justice on Nabal, and David is spared from taking justice into his own hands. And he and Abigail end up getting married, which is what you do when you're the king and you like a woman. In those days, you just start marrying people. But amazing woman, really God's gift to David in this scene. All right, scene three. You got one more in you? Yeah? It's going to look a lot like scene one, okay? We got one more in us. So we have those first two scenes, and I mean, the way the narrator tells these stories is amazing. I mean, just the way that they weave these themes together, it's such great storytelling. All right, so verse 1, chapter 26, we find out something really depressing about Saul, really frustrating. The Ziphites went to Saul at Gibeah and said, "Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakilah, which faces Jeshimon?" So Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search there for David. Saul made his camp beside the road on the hill of Hakilah facing Jeshimon, but David stayed in the desert. When he saw that Saul had followed him there, he sent out scouts and learned that Saul had definitely arrived. So you see Saul back at his old games again, chasing David again. Same thing. And then in verse 5, we have this same twist of fate, the same change of circumstance, the same role reversal in the power dynamics between David and Saul. Verse 5, "Then David set out and went to the place where Saul had camped. He saw where Saul and Abner, son of Ner, the commander of the..." That sounds funny. I'm Abner, son of Ner. That makes sense. "The commander of the army," he's Saul's commander, "had lain down." So they're lying down in the camp. It's night. "Saul was lying inside the camp with the army encamped around him. David then asked Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai, son of Zerai, Joab's brother, 'Who will go down into the camp with me to Saul?' 'I'll go with you,' said Abishai. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul." And we learned that God has put a sleep over the whole camp. "There was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying around him." So again, you've got this complete role reversal where David has been on the run, he's being chased again, and now there's Saul, totally vulnerable, asleep, and his spear is stuck in the ground a foot away from his vulnerable little head, and that's the same spear that he's thrown at David 3 times to try to kill him. And so you've got the same situation again where David has this unique opportunity. And again, you get the same words from his soldiers. Look at verse 8. "Abishai said to David, 'Today God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Now let me," this time he doesn't say, "David, you do it." He said, "I'll make it easy. Let me do this time, David. Now let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I won't strike him twice, won't take 2 shots, David." So imagine being David, okay? Again, what would you be thinking? I'd be thinking, "Man, I should have taken him out the first time. And now God's given me another opportunity, and here, I'm going to do it." But David, you've got this remarkably similar situation to 2 scenes ago with 2 key differences. David has learned 2 very important things. First, he's learned something about Saul. And what he's learned about Saul is never going to change, right? Saul is never going to change. I mean, David experienced this great moment where Saul's weeping, he's repenting, there's this reconciliation. You're thinking, this is going to be what changes him. And David realizes now, Saul is never going to change, and my acts of mercy made no difference at all in terms of what's going on in his heart. He is never going to change. So this is a different situation. But secondly, David has learned something about God. He's learned, as we'll see later, that God rewards righteousness and faithfulness. That God is a God of justice, and he's just seen that in his encounter with Nabal, that he was spared from enacting justice, and God came through and was just and did what was right and just in that situation. And so David has a fuller confidence that his God really is a God who rewards righteousness and punishes unfaithfulness and wickedness. So let's see what David does. Verse 9, David says to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" And then he's got a new confidence in God's justice here. Look at this. "As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "the Lord himself will strike Saul. Either his time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed." So he has this greater sense. God is just. God will do what is right and good in this circumstance. I don't have to take this into my own hands. End of verse 11. "Now get the spear." This is the symbol now of Saul's, you know, anger. "Get the spear and the water jug that are near his head, and let's go." So verse 12, David takes the spear and the water jug near Saul's head, and they left. No one saw or knew about it. The Lord put them in a deep sleep. Verse 13, this time David creates a little more space between him and Saul. I think he's getting a little wiser. So verse 13, David crosses over to the other side and stood on top of the hill some distance away. There was a wide space between them. And then he does a little fun here. He calls out to Abner, son of Ner, aren't you going to answer me, Abner? Abner replied, who are you who calls to the king? David says, you're a man, aren't you? And who is like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard your lord the king? Someone came to destroy your lord the king. What you've done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men deserve to die because you didn't guard your master, the Lord's anointed. Look around you. Where are the king's spear and water jug that were near his head? And Saul realizes it's David, and again, he has the same response. It's like coming out of a dream. Verse 17, Saul recognizes David's voice. Is that your voice, David, my son? David replies, yes, it is, my lord, the king. And he added, why is my lord pursuing his servant? What have I done? And what wrong am I guilty of? He goes on to say more things. Verse 21, Saul says, I have sinned. Come back. Come here, David. Come back, David, my son. Because you considered my life precious today, I will not try to harm you again. Surely I have acted like a fool and have erred greatly. And David, I think in his wisdom, says, you know what? Here's your spear, the spear that's tried to kill me. I'm not going to come back. I'm not going to walk over to you right now. Let one of your young men come over and get it. And then here's our line for the day. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for trusting in God and doing the right thing. The Lord delivered you into my hands today, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. As surely as I valued your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all trouble. Then Saul said to David, may you be blessed, my son David. You will do great things and surely triumph. So David went on his way, and Saul returned home. And this is the last recorded time where they see each other. This is their last encounter. And what we find out is that David's words in verse 10 are true. And Saul's time does come. And at the end of 1 Samuel, Saul is in a battle against the Philistines, and he's being routed. He ends up taking his own life. And then in 2 Samuel, David takes the throne, which God gives to him. And he is able to come to the throne without the guilty conscience of having avenged himself. The Lord rewards righteousness and faithfulness. So pretty cool set of stories, huh? Clearly meant to convey a similar theme. And as I look at it, as I close, I look at David and what he realized, his perspective, was that the God's kingdom is just that. You know, it's God's kingdom. And it's God's role to enact justice. It's his role to bring his kingdom in his way. And he's not looking for children who are going to bring in his kingdom on their own, who are going to enact justice on his own. He's looking for righteousness and faithfulness. He's looking for his children to trust him and do the right thing, even in the midst of injustice, even when it's hard. It's children who trust that God is a God of justice. He is the one who can bring about justice. And it's not my role to have to do that. And so I want you to consider yourself, your own situations where you experience injustice. Obviously, they're not going to be as dramatic as David's. But where are those places in your history or even now where that justice meter is just off the charts? Where you're going, this is not fair. I've been good and faithful, and I'm getting, you know, evil coming back my way. Again, you know, it could be a work situation where your boss is just totally unfair, or you've got a coworker who is, you know, totally misrepresenting you or doing what they want to do to move ahead. Maybe you got a friend right now who's talking behind your back, who's doing things you're like, this is just not right. I don't know why they're treating me this way. Maybe you've got a neighbor. Maybe you've got, you know, those backyard wars where the tree is way over on your side of the lawn, you know, these little things. But you've got a neighbor and you're like, this person just mistreats me. It could be little, could be a big thing. Maybe it's your spouse and you're in a marriage right now where you're like, man, this just does not feel fair. This doesn't feel just what I'm experiencing right now. You know, the injustice done to us is probably more subtle than it's being to David. And our opportunities for revenge are probably more subtle. You know, it's probably not, I'm going to go kill this person. but maybe it's your opportunities. You know, I'm just going to shoot out some really evil words at this person. That's what I want to do. I want to get even with my words. Or maybe you want to do something downright nasty to them. you want to do something that this would just feel so good to go and do this. Some of you are more aggressive. You know, you live the way you drive your car. You know, if that person cuts me off, you know what I do? I pull off into their lane, I speed up, pull back in their lane, and slam on the brakes. That's how I roll. and maybe that's how you like to get justice. And some of you are more passive aggressive, and maybe justice is maybe you enact justice by withdrawing from a relationship. Someone hurts you, say, "I'm going to withdraw. That's how I'm going to get even with you." Or maybe it's, "I'm going to go talk about you behind your back and slander you or say things, to friends. That's how I get back." Or maybe you're really passive and it's like, "You know, I'm going to go away and I'm going to have some really mean conversations in my head about you." You know, maybe that's about as far as you go in terms of justice. How do we handle the anger and that desire for justice? And we obviously don't have time to talk about all the emotional and psychological dynamics, but I want to just leave you with this kind of core theological perspective, how we deal with injustice. And we've got these two key theological pillars, and one, of course, is the mercy of God. There was this God that is so merciful to us, that he's forgiven us so many things, so how could we not go out and then forgive people who have been wrong to us? And that's, of course, a key pillar. But the other one that we're talking about today is the justice of God. That God is a God of justice, and his mercy, that is true, but he is still a God of justice. He's a God who will set things right. And it's that core belief that one day there's someone who is going to set all things right. And, you know, if you've had a life like me, where you haven't had a lot of injustice, life has been good and easy, you probably don't feel that deep need for that justice. But if you look back in history and Christians and what they've experienced, or even maybe some of you in your own life that have experienced such great injustices, there's just this core longing of the human heart that I need to know in the midst of this completely unfair situation that someone out there, there's going to be some justice that takes place in the universe. There's some judge who will know how to set things right, and he'll be wise and good and loving in how he does that. And that's a good, I think, a good human impulse. And the gospel is that we have a God who is a just God, that he knows how to set things right in the end, and that he rewards righteousness and faithfulness, and he punishes unfaithfulness and evil, and that he is the only being in the universe that has the perspective, that has the wisdom, and that has the purity to be able to do that well. And how presumptuous of me to think that I know exactly what that should look like, and that I'm the right person to go out and enact that. And so I think that's such a core perspective that we need to have, and that David realized that, yes, there is a God out there, and he is just, and he will, in his own way, in his own time, and according to his wisdom, he will make things right. And practically speaking, what that means, and again, I know that there's a lot of emotional stuff that I'm not talking about, but if we can really embrace that, practically speaking, what it means is that we're freed up from having to enact justice ourselves, right, in our relationships. We are freed up. I don't have to enact justice. I know that someone else, according to his plan, he knows what's right and he can do that. So I'm freed up to love people. I'm freed up to care for them, to treat them with kindness and respect and goodness, regardless of what they're doing. I'm freed up because I know that someone else, he gets that, and he will know how to deal with that according to his wisdom and his goodness. Now, obviously, you need an eternal perspective in that. David got to see justice, you know, in like 10 days. Well, we don't get to see that. So it's a little harder for us. But I think that's the right perspective for us, is I don't need to retaliate. I don't need to make sure that this is fair in my relationships, because that's God's job. God's judge. I'm not judge. I want to share a couple verses with you. I think of Jesus as the great example of this. And again, this idea that God rewards righteousness and faithfulness. He rewards people who trust him and do what's good, even in the midst of injustice. Look at Jesus, the great example, when he goes to the cross. When they hurled their insults at him, he didn't retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats, and here it is. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. In the midst of injustice, Jesus said, "You know what, my God, he will deal with this justly, and I'm going to entrust this situation to him." And then Peter goes on to say this: "So then, those who suffer, and I would add, at the hands of others, according to God's will, here it is, should commit themselves to their faithful Creator and continue to do good. Trust God and keep doing good." And of course, Paul says in Romans 12, "Don't repay anyone evil for evil. Don't take revenge, my friends. Leave room. Leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It's mine to avenge. I will repay,' says the Lord. Leave room for God's justice. We don't need to be the judge. That's God's role. Now, just want to say one more thing that I think is key. This does not mean that we are just passive victims of injustice. I don't think that's what Christ calls his people. It doesn't mean we're doormats. This is not like a theological excuse for people who aren't strong enough to stand up for themselves. Okay, that's not what this is. I actually think this is a very proactive thing. It's a very courageous thing. And you look at David in these three scenes, there's nothing passive about him, right? There's nothing wimpy or you know, just kind of passive about him. He's very proactive. He goes out and he cuts that little thing and he comes out to Saul and says, "Saul, look, here I am." I mean, it's a very risky thing to do. "Look at me. I could have done this to you, but I didn't." And he stands up to Saul. "The Lord judge between you and me, Saul. Okay? I'm right and you're wrong. And yet I'm not gonna seek justice. I'm gonna leave that up to God." But it's not passive. It's a very active thing. I think of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, "I want you to love your enemies, those people who are so unjust to you. Love your enemies," and then he gives us these very proactive things to do. "I want you to pray for those who persecute you. Take that energy and use it to pray for them." And then he goes on and says, "If someone slaps you on one side of the cheek," he doesn't say just walk away, he says, "Hey, no, turn the other cheek. Say, you want to slap the other side? Here it is. You can have it. If someone says, if someone sues you and takes a cloak, say, hey, you can have my tunic too. If a soldier comes along and says, I want you to carry my stuff 1 mile, say, I'll take it 2 miles. It's just very proactive. You know, it's not passive. It's not wimpy. It's saying, I am going to do good to you no matter what. I'm going to continue to do what is loving and what is courageous and what is merciful no matter what you do, because the Lord rewards righteousness and faithfulness. God, he knows what justice is, and I've entrusted that to him. I don't have to worry about that, so I'm free to just keep on loving you. So I want to ask you, as you think about your own life, as you look at the story of David, where is that situation where you need to just let go of trying to enact justice? Where do you need to just go, you know what, this is so unfair, but I can let go. It doesn't have to be fair. That's God will deal with that in his timing. Where's that place? And then even in that, maybe you need to think, where can I actually be proactive to love and be courageous to step into something, even in the midst of injustice? And I wanted to close by just talking about one relationship that is closest to so many of us, and it's marriage. And I know many of you are not married, but many of you are here. And I think this whole attitude needs to start in the relationships that are closest to us. And so as I thought about this week, I just thought about marriages and how we deal with our marriages. And I just want to encourage us all by saying, let's not let justice become the standard of our marriages. As we think about how do I treat my spouse, let's not let justice be the standard, where it's tit for tat, where it's an eye for an eye, where it's if he or she has mistreated me, then I'm going to respond in kind. And I just see, you know, in my limited time as a married guy and in my limited counseling with married couples, is that that's where marriages go wrong, when justice becomes the measurement for each individual. And when the focus, and I see this in counseling, the focus is turned on the other person. And it's, here are the things that they are not doing for me. And you come into a counseling session, and what you get is a list of grievances from each couple, right? A list of injustices. This is what they're not doing. He's totally emotionally unavailable to me. Or we have no time together. We have no connection. There's no sex. There's no spark. She nags all the time. He's so distant. I mean, all these, just this list of grievances, and they might be totally legitimate. They may be totally true and accurate. But the problem comes when we say, I'm going to respond in kind. My wife is not loving me the way I want her to. So I'm freed up to do what I want. Or my husband is not doing what I want, so I'm gonna react in kind. And so I want to encourage us, and what I would love, you know, every couple, if all we did was just take, like, you know, Ephesians 5, where it talks about wives and husbands, if all we did is just take that, where it says, wives, you know, respect your husbands the way you'd respect Christ. And husbands, love your wives the way that Christ loves the church. If the husbands just took the husband role and said, this is my role, this is what I'm committed to do, and if they didn't even know what the wife's role was, they didn't even get to read the part about the wife, they just said, this is what this is what I'm commanded to do. This is what I'm being called to do. Okay, so every day I'm going to wake up and say, how can I love my wife the way Christ loves the church? And that's all I need to worry about. I don't need to worry about what she's doing with me, if she's fulfilling her role. I don't even need to know what that is. I just need to know that I need to love her. I need to give myself up for her daily, no matter what she's doing, unconditionally. And for the wife to say, wake up and say, I need to respect my husband the way I had to respect Christ. I don't need to know what his role is, because I can't totally control that, but I'm called to be faithful to this, regardless of whether I'm experiencing justice in this relationship. So I think this perspective begins even in those relationships that are closest in our lives. The Lord rewards righteousness and faithfulness, which is trusting God and doing the right thing. Let's pray. Well, Father, in the midst of a world that is very unjust, and many of us here, myself included, probably can't even understand what injustice looks like in the extreme form. But in the midst of an unjust world, we do thank you that justice is an inherent part of your character. And that one day you will make all things right, and it will be good and wise, and we will acknowledge that you are just and good and right. And we ask in the midst of our relationships that you would remind us of that, and that would free us up to not feel like we have to be the ones to enact justice in our relationships. You'd free us up to love, to a courageous, risky love and forgiveness in the midst of what might feel unfair. We pray as we do that, that we'd be a great testimony, a great reflection of your Son, and a great way to bring you glory. So give us the strength, give us the perspective to do that. And we ask, especially in those situations where we're feeling that right now, that you come alongside us with your perspective and strengthen us. Give us courage. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen. As always, there are people who would love to pray with you during this time of worship. Right beyond those blue doors to the right, we have a prayer room, so I invite you there now and even after the service.